Good morning, and thank you for spending your Sunday morning with us. It's really wonderful, a wonderful way to spend part of the weekend together. Today's Dharma talk comes to us from California. Nom Mon Tim Burnett will be talking about continuous practice. Thank you so very much.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks, everybody. Those bells are coming through really well, Desiree. I don't know. You have the perfect sound settings and the perfect bells.
I just got the original sound in place.
Original sound. Morning.
I think it's better.
Better. Yeah, sound good. So it takes a few. There's settings buried deep, and then you can turn it on. So that's good that you did that. Anyway, so I was just thinking about our practice and just how much I love this sense of continuousness, you know, continuity, just carrying on, but not doggedly either, right? So carrying on with a certain kind of spirit. I love this quote from Suzuki Roshi that we put on our little paper brochures back when we had a lobby with paper brochures in it. Our way is to practice one step at a time, one breath at a time, with no gaining idea. Practicing one step at a time, one breath at a time, with no gaining idea. And no gaining idea doesn't mean we don't have inspiration, you know, and hope for ourselves and our all beings and our planet. But that, you know, that release of sort of stickiness, you know, just practicing. And, you know, Suzuki Roshi was a great follower of Dogen, and he would quote bits and pieces of Dogen in his talks. To my knowledge, Suzuki Roshi never had time to just kind of systematically go through different parts of Shobo Genzo, but I think most of his quotations of Dogen were from Shobo Genzo somewhere. Anyway, so a great expression from Dogen of this spirit of continuous practice is the essay by him with that exact same name, Continuous Practice, Gyoji. I don't know if the Monday Night group has gotten that far. It's pretty far into the first volume, so maybe another decade before you get there, but anyway, you want to skip ahead sometime. This is the opening of Continuous Practice by Dogen. On the great road of Buddha ancestors, there is always unsurpassable practice, continuous and sustained. It forms the circle of the way and is never cut off. Between aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana, there is not a moment's gap. Continuous practice is the circle of the way. Between aspiration, so we are inspired, right? Aspiration, practice, we're practicing, enlightenment, whatever that is, nirvana, all these things, there's not a moment's gap. And he goes on to say that our continuous practice doesn't just help us along. It has this huge, unbelievable effect, you know, literally unimaginable effect. It goes on to say, by continuous practice of all Buddhas and ancestors, your practice is realized and your great road opens up. So that's how we think, right? By the continuous practice of all Buddhas and ancestors, your practice is actualized. And your great road opens up. Then he says, by your continuous practice, the continuous practice of all Buddhas is actualized, and the great road of all Buddhas opens up. Your continuous practice creates a circle of the way. By this practice, Buddha ancestors abide as Buddha, non-abide as Buddha, have Buddha mind, and attain Buddha without any cutting off. So we tend to think of our ancestors empowering us forward. So this is this wonderful circle idea, right? That it's not that way. It's both all directions at once. our ancestors inspire us and we inspire our ancestors with our continuous practice. And then it gets even further far out. Because of this practice, there are the sun, the moon, and the stars. Because of this practice, there is the great earth and the open sky. Because of this practice, there are body, mind, and their environs. Because of this practice, there are the four great elements and the five skandhas. Continuous practice is not necessarily something people in the world love, but it should be the true place of return for everyone. Because of the continuous practice of all Buddhas of the past, present, and future, all Buddhas of the past, present, and future are actualized. So this is such great kind of, this stuff is like yoga for the mind, you know what I mean? It stretches our mind in a way, shows us the places that we can't stretch to, right? Because we don't really think this way at all, right? We are going about our business thinking we're separate and trying to decide what to do each day, each moment, you know? Should I sit today? I don't know, I don't really feel like it. Wait! The universe needs me to sit. The universe needs me to actualize the sun, moon, and stars, you know, and empower all the Buddhas. So that changes the frame a little bit, you know, on our activities. And also, this is my example there is narrowing practice down to sitting, and of course, Dogen, Suzuki Roshi, all of our tradition has a much bigger idea of practice than just Zazen, although, you know, just Zazen is infinitely deep, right? That is, practice as life, life as practice. How shall I express my life right now, today, in this way that Dogen and Suzuki Roshi are talking about? Unfolding the circle of the way, actualizing the sun, the moon, and the stars, and all of our ancestors. You know, it has a feeling to it, right? These kind of words, this kind of way of talking, like, wow. And a quality of steadiness. That's what's really kind of struck me today. One step at a time, one breath at a time, practicing, practicing, practicing. You know, and not that we don't hope for this to be beneficial. Why would we do it, you know? But there's something about this no gaining idea that is just a deep, deep thought. You know, no gaining idea. Anyway, all this made me think of a story in the Western tradition too, which maybe you know, and it bears hearing again if you've heard this story before. I want to share with you a story from the middle of the 20th century by a French writer named Jean Genet. This is the story of the man who planted trees. So sit back and relax. Let's have a story of continuous practice from the West. And I think that Dogen would appreciate this story. Let me see if I can get it a little bit bigger there. Sorry. Okay, here we go. So you got to kind of settle into this language. It's he wrote it in French, but it was first published in English. So I think this author was quite fluent in both languages. But it has a kind of old-fashioned-y style to it, so you have to kind of settle into the style. The Man Who Planted Trees. For a human character to reveal truly exceptional qualities, one must have the good fortune to be able to observe its performance over many years. If this performance is devoid of all egoism, if the guiding motive is unparalleled generosity, it is absolutely certain that there is no thought of recompense, and that, in addition, it has left its visible mark upon the earth, then there can be no mistake. This is a human character of exceptional quality. About 40 years ago, I was taking a long trip on foot over mountain heights quite unknown to tourists in that ancient region where the Alps thrust down into Provence. All this at the time I embarked upon my long walk through these deserted regions was barren and colorless land. Nothing grew there but wild lavender. I was crossing the area at its widest point, and after 3 days walking, found myself in the midst of unparalleled desolation. I camped near the vestiges of an abandoned village. I had run out of water the day before and had to find some. These clustered houses, although in ruins like an old wasp's nest, suggested there must have once been a spring or a well here. There was indeed a spring, but it was dry. The five or six houses roofless, gnawed by wind and rain, the tiny chapel with its crumbling steeple stood about like houses and chapels in living villages, but all life had vanished. It was a fine June day, brilliant with sunlight, but over this unsheltered land, high in the sky, the wind blew with unendurable ferocity. It growled over the carcass of the houses like a lion disturbed at its meal. I had no choice but to move my camp. After 5 hours walking, I had not found water still, and there was nothing to give me any hope of finding any. All about me was the same dryness, the same coarse grasses. I thought I glimpsed in the distance a small black silhouette, upright, and took it for the trunk of a solitary tree. But in any case, I started towards it. It was a shepherd. 30 sheep were lying about him, basking on the earth. He gave me a drink from his water gourd, and a little later took me to his cottage in a fold of the plain. There he drew water, excellent water, from a very deep natural well, above which he had constructed a primitive winch. The man spoke little. This is the way of those who live alone. But one felt that he was sure of himself, confident in his assurance. That was unexpected in this barren country. He lived not in a cabin, but in a real house made of stone that bore plain evidence of how his own efforts had reclaimed the ruin he had found there upon his arrival. The roof was strong and sound. The wind on its tiles made the sound of the sea upon the shore. The place was in order, the dishes washed, the floor swept, his rifle oiled, his soup boiling over the fire. I noticed that he was cleanly shaved, that all his buttons were firmly sewn on. His clothing had been mended with a meticulous care that makes the mending invisible. He shared his soup with me, and afterwards, when I offered my tobacco pouch, he told me he did not smoke. His dog, silent as himself, was friendly without being servile. It was understood from the first that I should spend the night there. The nearest village was still more than a day and a half away. Besides, I was perfectly familiar with the nature of the rare villages in that region by now. There were four or five of them scattered well apart from each other on these mountain slopes, among white oak thickets at the extreme end of the wagon roads. And they were inhabited by charcoal burners, and the living there was bad. Families crowded together in a climate that is excessively harsh both in winter and summer, found no escape from unending conflict of personalities, irrational ambition, reached inordinate proportions in the continual desire for escape in these mean villages. The men took their wagon loads of charcoal to town and then returned. The soundest characters broke under the perpetual grind. The women nursed their grievances. There was rivalry in everything, over the price of charcoal as over a pew in church, over warring virtues as over warring vices, as well as over the ceaseless combat between virtue and vice. And over all this was the wind, ceaseless, rasping upon the nerves. There was an epidemic of suicide, frequent cases of insanity, usually homicidal. That's the environment, yeah. The shepherd went to fetch a small sack and poured out a heap of acorns on the table. And then he began to inspect them one by one with great concentration, separating good from bad. I smoked my pipe and did not offer to help him. I did offer to help him, but he told me it was his job. And in fact, seeing the care he devoted to the task, I did not insist. That was the whole of our conversation. When he had set aside a large enough pile of good acorns, he counted them out by tens, meanwhile eliminating the small ones and those that were even slightly cracked, for now he examined them even more closely. When he had thus selected 100 perfect acorns, he stopped and went to bed. There was a peace in being with this man. The next day I asked if I might rest here for a day. He found it quite natural, or to be more exact, he gave me the impression that nothing whatever could startle him. My rest was not absolutely necessary, but I was interested and wished to know more about him. He opened the pen and led his flock to pasture, but before leaving he plunged his sack of carefully selected and counted acorns into a pail of water. I noticed that he carried for a stick an iron rod as thick as my thumb and about a yard and a half long. Resting myself by walking, I followed a path parallel to his. His pasture was in a valley. He left the dog in charge of the little flock and climbed towards where I stood. I was afraid he was about to rebuke me for my indiscretion, but that was not it at all. This was just the way he was going, and he invited me to go along if I had nothing better to do. He climbed to the top of the ridge about 100 yards away. There he began thrusting his iron rod into the earth, making a hole in which he placed an acorn and then refilled the hole. He was planting oak trees. I asked him if the land belonged to him. He answered no. Did he know whose it was? He did not. He supposed it was community property or perhaps belonged to people who cared nothing about it. He was not interested in finding out whose it was. He planted his 100 acorns with the greatest care. After the midday meal, he resumed his planting. I suppose I must have been fairly insistent in my questioning, for he answered me. For 3 years he had been planting trees in this wilderness. He had planted 100,000. Of the 100,000, 20,000 had sprouted. Of the 20,000, he expected still to lose about half, to rodents or the unpredictable designs of Providence. There remained 10,000 oak trees to grow where nothing had grown before. That was when I began to wonder about the age of this man. He was obviously over 50. 55, he told me. His name was Elazar Bouffier. He had once had a farm in the lowlands. There he had had his life, but he had lost his only son and then his wife, and he had withdrawn into solitude, where his pleasure was to live leisurely with his lambs and his dogs, and his dog. It was his opinion that this land was dying for want of trees. He added that having no very pressing business of his own, he had resolved to remedy this state of affairs. Since I was at that time, in spite of my youth, leading a solitary life, I understood how to deal gently with solitary spirits. But my very youth forced me to consider the future in relation to myself and a certain quest for happiness. I told him that in 30 years his 10,000 oaks would be magnificent. He answered quite simply that if God granted him life in 30 years, he would have planted so many more than those 10,000. That they would be like a drop of water in the ocean. Besides, he was now studying the reproduction of beech trees and had a nursery of seedlings grown from beech nuts near his cottage. The seedlings, which he had protected from his sheep with a wire fence, were beautiful. He had also considered birches for the valleys where, he told me, there was a certain amount of moisture a few yards below the surface of the soil. The next day we parted. In the following year came the War of 1914, so World War I, in which I was involved for the next 5 years, and infantrymen hardly had time to reflect upon trees. To tell the truth, the thing itself had made no impression upon me. I'd considered it a hobby, a stamp collection, a curiosity, and forgotten about it. When the war was finally over, I found myself possessed of a tiny demobilization bonus and a huge desire to breathe fresh air for a while. And it was no other objective that I again took the road to the barren lands. The countryside had not changed. However, beyond the deserted village, I glimpsed in the distance a sort of grayish mist that covered the mountaintops like a carpet. Since the day before, I began to think again of the shepherd tree planter. 10,000 oaks, I reflected. Really must take up quite a bit of space. I had seen so many men die during those 5 years, too many not to imagine easily, that Elazar Bouffier was by now dead, especially since at 20, one regards men of 50 as old men with nothing left to do but die. But he was not dead. As a matter of fact, he was extremely spry. He had changed jobs. Now he had only 4 sheep, but instead 100 beehives. He had got rid of the sheep because they threatened his young trees. For he told me, and I saw myself, the war had disturbed him not at all. He had imperturbably continued to plant. The oaks of 1910 were now 10 years old and taller than either of us. It was an impressive spectacle, I was literally speechless, as he did not talk. We spent the whole day walking in silence through his forest. In three sections, it measured 11 kilometers in length, three at its greatest widths. When you remember, this had all sprung up from the hands and soul of a single man without technical resources. You understood what humans could do, that humans could be as effectual as God in other realms than merely in destruction. For he had pursued his plan, and birch trees as high as my shoulder, spread out as far as the eye could reach, confirmed it. He showed me handsome clumps of birch planted 5 years ago, that is in 1915, when I had been fighting at Verdun. He had set them all in the valleys where he had guessed, and guessed rightly, that there was moisture enough below the surface of the ground. They were as delicate as young girls and well established. Creation seemed to have come about in a sort of chain reaction. He did not worry about it. He was determinedly pursuing his task in all its simplicity. But as we went back towards the village, I saw that water now flowed in the brooks that had been dry since human memory. And this was an impressive result of a chain reaction that I had seen. The dry streams had long ago had run with water. Some of the dreary villages I mentioned before had been built on the sites of ancient Roman settlements, traces of which still remained. An archaeologist exploring there had found fish hooks, where in the 20th century cisterns were needed to supply a small amount of water. The wind, too, had scattered seeds. As the water reappeared, so reappeared willows, rushes, meadows, gardens, flowers, and a certain purpose in being alive. But the transformation took place so gradually that it became part of a pattern without us causing any astonishment. Hunters climbing into the wilderness in pursuit of hares or wild boar had of course noticed the sudden growth of little trees, but it had attributed it to some wild caprice of the earth. That is why no one meddled with Elazar Bouffier's work. If he had been detected, he would surely have experienced opposition. But he was indetectable. Who in the villages or in the administration would have dreamed of such perseverance and such magnificent generosity? To have anything like a precise idea of his exceptional character, one must not forget that he worked in total solitude, so total that, towards the end of his life, he lost the habit of speech, or perhaps it was that he felt saw no more need for it. In 1933, he received a visit from a forest ranger who notified him of an order against lighting fires out of doors for fear of endangering the growth of the new natural forest. It was the first time the man told him naively that he had ever heard of a forest growing of its own accord. At that time, Bouffier was about to plant beeches in a spot some 12 kilometers from his cottage. In order to avoid traveling back and forth, he was then 75. He planned to build a stone cabbage right at the plantation, and the next year he did so. And then in 1935, a whole delegation came from the government to examine the natural forest. There was a high official from the Forest Service, a deputy, technicians. There was a great deal of ineffectual talk. It was decided that something must be done, and fortunately, nothing was done, except for the only helpful thing. The whole forest was placed under the protection of the state, and charcoal burning was prohibited, for it was impossible not to be captivated by the beauty of those young trees and the fullness of health as they cast their spell over the deputy himself. I know of this because a friend of mine was among the forestry officers at the delegation. To him I explained the mystery. And one day the following week, my friend and I went together to see Elazar Bouffier. We found him hard at work, some 10 kilometers from the spot where the inspection had taken place. This forester was not my friend for nothing. He was aware of values, and he paid attention. He knew how to keep silent. I delivered the eggs I had brought as a present. We shared our lunch among the three of us and spent several hours in wordless contemplation of the countryside. In the direction from which we had come, slopes were now covered with trees, 20 to 25 feet tall. I remembered the land, how the land had looked in 1913, a desert. but peaceful, regular toil, vigorous mountain air, frugality, and above all, serenity of spirit, had endowed this old man with awe-inspiring health. He was one of God's great athletes. I wondered how many more acres he was going to cover with trees. Before leaving, my friend simply made a brief suggestion about certain species of trees that the soil here seemed particularly suited for. He did not force the point, simply mentioned the idea. For very good reason, he told me later. That Monsieur Bouffier knows more about it than I do anyway. At the end of an hour's walking, having turned it over in his mind, my friend added, he knows a lot more about it than anybody. He's discovered a wonderful way to be happy. It was thanks to this officer that not only was the forest, but the happiness of the man was protected. He delegated three rangers to the task, and so terrorized them that they remained proof against all bottles of wine and other bribes that the charcoal burners could offer. The only serious danger to the work came during the War of 1939, so World War II now, as cars were now run on gasogenes, wood-burning generators, and there was never enough wood. Cutting started among the oaks of 1910, but the area was far from any railroads, and the enterprise turned out to be financially unsound and was abandoned. The shepherd had seen nothing of it. He was 30 kilometers away at the time, peacefully continuing his work, ignoring the War of 1939 as he ignored the War of 1914. I saw Elzard Bouffier for the last time in June of 1945. He was then 87. I had started back along the route through the wastelands, but now, in spite of the disorder in which the war had left the country, there was a bus running between Durance Valley and the mountains. I attributed the fact that I no longer recognized the scenes of my earlier journey to this relatively speedy transportation. It seemed to me, too, that the route took me through new territory. It took me in the name of a village to convince me that, no, I was actually in the same region that had been all ruin and desolation. The bus put me down at Vergonne. In 1913, this hamlet of 10 or 12 houses had had 3 inhabitants, and they had been savage creatures, hating one another, living by trapping game, little removed, both physically and morally, from the conditions of prehistoric humanity. All about them, nettles were feeding upon the remains of abandoned houses, and their condition had been beyond hope. For them, nothing to do but await death. But everything had changed, even the air, even the harsh, dry winds that used to attack me. Instead, a gentle breeze was blowing, laden with scents. A sound like water came from the mountains. It was the wind in the forest. Most amazing of all, I heard the actual sound of water falling into a pool. I saw that a fountain had been built, and that it flowed freely, and which touched me most, that someone had placed a linden, had planted a linden behind it, a linden that must have been 4 years old, already in full leaf, the incontestable symbol of resurrection. Besides Vergonne bore evidence of labor. Verdun bore evidence of labor at the sort of undertaking for which hope is required. Hope had returned. Ruins had been cleared away, dilapidated walls torn down, 5 houses restored. There were now 28 inhabitants, 4 of them young married couples. The new houses, freshly plastered, were surrounded by gardens where vegetables and flowers grew in orderly confusion, cabbages and roses, leeks and snapdragons, celery and anemone. It was now a village where one would like to live. From that point, I went on foot. The war just finished had not yet allowed the full blossoming of life, but Lazarus was out of the tomb. On the lower slopes of the mountain, I saw little fields of barley and rye deep in the mountain valleys, and meadows were turning green. It had taken only eight years since then for the whole countryside to glow with health and prosperity. On the site of ruins I had seen in 1913 now stood neat farms, cleanly plastered, testifying to a happy and comfortable life. The old streams fed by rains and snows from the forest conserves were flowing again, the waters channeled, and in each farm groves of maples, fountain pools overflow into carpets of fresh mint. Little by little the villages have been rebuilt. People from the plains, where land is costly, have settled here, bringing youth, motion, and a spirit of adventure. Along the roads, you meet hardy men and women, boys and girls who understood laughter and have recovered a taste for picnics. Counting the former population unrecognizable now that live in comfort, more than 10,000 people owe their happiness to Elazar Bouffier. When I reflect that one man, armed only with his own physical and moral resources, was able to cause this land of Canaan to spring from a wasteland, I'm convinced that in spite of everything, humanity is admirable. But when I compute the unfailing greatness of spirit and tenacity of benevolence that it must have taken to achieve this result, I'm taken with an immense respect for that old and learned peasant who was able to complete a work worthy of God. Elazar Bouffier died peacefully in 1947 at the hospice in Bonnone. So, it's the story of the man who planted trees. There's a wonderful animated version of this, actually, like line drawing animation, really beautiful. So this was written right after World War II, and the author lived through both wars. So, An Expression of Hope, published in 1953. And then I was reading that he gave away copies of this, and he organized it somehow to give away lots of copies of the story and translate it into several languages, and that he enjoyed when anyone asked him whether Elazar Bouffier was real and whether this was a true story, he would just smile. He wouldn't answer. And actually, of course, he did make it up. It's a fictional story, or at least from the dualistic categories of fiction and truth, we would have to put in fiction. He tipped his hand late in his life in a letter to a village official in one of those in that region. And he wrote, "Sorry to disappoint you, but Elazar Bouffier is a fictional person. The goal was to make trees likable, or more specifically, to make planting trees likable." And he goes on in the letter to describe how the book, translated into multiple languages, was distributed freely and was a success. And he added, "It does not bring me a cent, and it is one of the texts which makes me the most proud." So, I always feel inspired by that story. It's just, we can be all rational and postmodern and say it's just a fable and blah, 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 but why not take inspiration for continuous practice where we can find it. It's planting one acorn at a time, 100 a day, one step at a time, one breath at a time, one donation to the food bank or Black Lives Matter at a time, or whatever our practice is, and continue on with hope. Dang, I think I forgot the opening chant again. Something about Sunday just feels so casual, so relaxed. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.